call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. Up first, I'll see if Vice Chair Agbaje would move the minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Minutes are moved. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Minutes are approved. I'll note a quorum is present. Members, we have two bills up today. They're two meaty bills, I would say, with lots of testifiers. I want to give each bill about an equal opportunity of discussion and an opportunity for members to ask questions of both bills. So I'd ask members to keep their presentation to 5 minutes, and I'd ask testifiers to keep their testimony to 2 minutes. My CA, Mr. Copel here, will have a minute sign. We'll give you a chance to know when you have a minute left. This way we can leave as much space as we can for members to ask questions of the authors and have a full discussion today about two bills that are important to our conversation around affordable housing. And the first bill before us today is House File 2235, Representative Elkins. And up first, I will move that House File 2235 be re-referred to the House State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. And with the bill before us, I'll turn to Representative Elkins. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is my first time in this committee.
I think so.
I should have brought treats. Anyway, yes, so let's get this show on the road. In August of 2020.
Sorry, Representative, can you move the microphone a little closer?
Oh, yeah, this it's we're in room five.
Yes.
In August of 2021, the Star Tribune published a front-page expose on how Twin Cities zoning ordinances perpetuate racially segregated living patterns in the Twin Cities. The investigative team that researched the story discovered case after case where development restrictions that had commonly been included in racially restrictive covenants had simply migrated from the covenants to municipal zoning codes, in some cases word for word, when the Supreme Court ruled those covenants unenforceable. Many of those restrictions live on today in current zoning codes in the Twin Cities especially. This isn't just a racial equity issue, it's a generational equity issue as well. Today, these same restrictions prevent the creation of a new generation of starter homes for young millennial families of all races and ethnicities. I was not yet 30 years old when my wife and I purchased our first starter home, which we referred to as the condo in Redondo. My two college-educated daughters, who are approaching their 40th birthdays, still have not purchased their first homes because the starter homes, quote-unquote, built for previous generations are beyond their means. House File 2235, the Legalizing Affordable Housing Act, is designed to sweep away barriers that prevent housing developers, both for-profit and nonprofit, from building housing that responds to the demand for housing of all kinds at more affordable price points. After all, it doesn't matter how much money the legislature appropriates to build new affordable housing if cities won't allow it to be built. In 2020, the Star Tribune published my own piece entitled The Twin Cities Housing, The Flaming Hoop Separating Builders and Cities, in which I observed that in the absence of a mechanism for cities to use development impact fees to directly defray the cost of building new infrastructure needed to support new housing projects, cities were resorting to backdoor mechanisms such as the plan unit development process to exact those fees from developers and limit housing development to expensive executive homes which would have quicker property tax payoff. Under the plan unit development process, the zoning code is essentially thrown out the window and the developer and city staff play let's make a deal. The plan unit development concept was invented to accommodate building sites with unique characteristics and novel development forms that were not contemplated when the zoning code was devised. Requiring the use of the PUD process to approve everyday housing projects adds unnecessary time, risk, cost to every housing project. We must get back to a process where housing developers have the right to build housing which complies with zoning codes designed to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. Therefore, the very first article in this bill would provide cities with a direct way for development to pay its own way, but no more. In exchange, the cities would be required by the provisions in later articles of the bill to relinquish the backdoor mechanisms that they currently use to exact indirect development fees from housing developers. That's the basic deal that I'm proposing in this bill between the cities and the housing developers. In this draft of the bill, the development impact fee would be similar to an assessment against the property owners whose land would be rendered more developable and therefore more valuable if the infrastructure, such as a new or expanded road, was built. This article will probably be revised to make it like Chapter 444 of the existing statutes, which provides an established tried-and-true funding mechanism for water and sewer infrastructure and could be easily extended to cover transportation infrastructure as well. So this is the first article, as just described, and enables, and I'll just walk through the individual articles point by point as quickly as I can to save time here. But the first article provides a mechanism for cities to assess, impact fees or assessments to cover the cost of building infrastructure that prepares their land for development so that development pays its own way. The second article is new from last year's bill. In the last year, we have seen where Minneapolis adopted its 2040 comprehensive plan, which included provisions which allow duplexes and triplexes in single-family neighborhoods. And in response, the city was sued by NIMBYs posing as our environmentalists to block the plan. Article 2 of the bill would outlaw these lawsuits by preventing comprehensive plans from being challenged under the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act. Before I get into the meat of the bill, I want to just address straight up the, what we'll, you hear a lot about the, this lo, about the issue of local control. So a basic understanding of Minnesota's zoning statutes is in order. So cities in Minnesota are creatures of the state, and they derive their zoning authority from Chapter 462. Chapter 473, which is known as the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, provides an overlay that describes the relationship between local governments in the Twin Cities region and the Met Council and the related requirements to comprehensive planning and zoning in the Twin Cities. And some of these provisions apply statewide. They're in Chapter 462. Others are strictly in 473 and apply only to Twin Cities cities. And I think we all need to recognize that the housing issues that are faced in the Twin Cities and places in greater Minnesota are different in nature. But I'm trying to do something that affects both cities in the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. So the last time, that's different, okay. Article 3 is mostly about reforms to the basic planning and zoning process. They reinstate, the last time that these statutes were updated in a major way was back in 1995. Since 1995, these provisions have been, kind of eroded away by court decisions and common practice that has come into place. And a lot of the 1995 reforms have effectively been, rendered meaningless through this erosion. So courts, for example, have observed that discrepancies between comprehensive plans and zoning can be resolved by either changing the zoning or the comp plan. So cities regularly conform their comp plans to their zoning, even though this is clearly not what the 1995 legislature intended. So the bill provides a common sense definition for what it means for zoning to be conforming to the comprehensive plan for the first time. It's a definition that I've had, vetted by some of the state's leading land use attorneys, who all basically have responded the same way by saying, that's what we assumed it meant all along. So existing law, it requires cities to conform their zoning to their comp plan within 9 months of an update to their comprehensive plan. If this is done, not been done, the bill adds a new requirement that the cities do so upon receipt of a development proposal that is consistent with the comp plan. In other words, the approval of the zoning change would be more or less automatic. The bill has a provision that prevents cities from freezing housing development by declaring a retroactive moratorium after the development proposal has been received. There's one city in the Twin Cities a few years ago that waited until it had applications for 1,000 units of multifamily housing and then froze all 1,000 units with a development moratorium after the applications were already in the works. And then finally, in this article, in order to qualify for the Twin Cities Livable Communities Grant Program, cities in the metro area must commit to including enough land within their comprehensive plan to accommodate that city's fair share of the region's affordable housing needs over the next decade. This bill requires that the land also be zoned for affordable housing to satisfy this requirement. I put that provision in because I was seeing cases where a city would guide land in its comprehensive plan for multifamily housing. A developer would work in good faith with city staff to bring forward a multifamily housing proposal. And then the city would deny the rezoning from single-family to multifamily when it came before them. And then would go back and change their comprehensive plan to conform it to the single-family zoning. And there's a lot of basically gaming of the livable communities program going on right now, and this would put a stop to it. So Article 4 limits regulations on development. These are the kinds of things that you know, you might have seen in restrictive covenants in the past. There's a provision that cities may not ban modular apartment buildings. This will be is broken out into a separate standalone bill as well. It allows duplexes and ADUs to be built in single-family zoning districts. My city, Bloomington, has always allowed duplexes in single-family zoning districts and has allowed ADUs for a long time. Many, many more cities are doing that. Minneapolis is very, very prominent attention for doing so. It says that the plan unit development process may not be imposed. So if a developer can bring forward a development that is completely consistent with the zoning, then it has to be evaluated under the zoning code. The city cannot force the developer under those circumstances to put the development through the plan unit development process simply so that they have a backdoor way of assessing development fees that aren't currently allowed by law. Purely aesthetic mandates would no longer be allowed. Multi-cart garages would no longer be able to be required, and minimum home or garage sizes would not be able to be required. There would be a cap on Article 5 on municipal dedication fees, the excessive dedication of land for roads, and the uses of dedication fees would have to be tracked and reported. In Article 6, plan average densities and comprehensive plans would have to be at least 4 units per acre. So currently, cities have the leeway to go between 3 and 5, but the Met Council in its infrastructure planning assumes that on average things will come out at the middle of about 4. However, in reality, development in newly developing areas is coming in at about 3.5 units per acre, which means that infrastructure is not being used effectively, and there are 16 cities in the developing suburbs where the average development is coming in at lower than 3 units per acre, meaning basically nothing but executive housing is being built in those suburbs. In Article 7, similarly, it's related to this. So when Met Council is planning sewer lines, they're building out, making their plans based on an assumption that land will be developed in an average density of 4 units per acre. So this says that when land is developed, it will be based on an assumption that that's the case, so that if a developer comes along and instead builds on half-acre lots, each of those homes on half-acre lots would have to pay 2 SAC charges. Article 8 is related to building permit deadlines. This is a constant sore point with builders. And in this year's version, it says that if the building application is not acted on within 60 days, the city still is required to process it as expeditiously as possible. But if the approval process stretches out after 60 days, they have to give the fees back to the developer at the end of the process. Article 9, which will also be in a standalone bill, which is in labor and industry, it will provide a standard methodology for cities to estimate how much a home is going to be worth or going to cost to build for purposes of assessing building fees. And 11 is the other half. It also raises the reporting threshold for cities to report to DLI on what they're doing with their building fees. So Article 9 and Article 11 have been put together into a separate standalone bill, and these two provisions have not been controversial. Article 10 on energy cost disclosures. Developers have complained for years that they don't feel that home sellers or home buyers adequately value energy cost savings from energy-efficient homes. When I explored this, I discovered that the reason is that they aren't provided any information. So Article 10 requires home sellers to disclose energy cost information to prospective home buyers so that they can put value on the energy efficiency being built into today's homes. And finally, Article 12 just simply repeals session law that would allow the cities of Oak Grove and now then exclusively to basically ignore these kinds of laws. And on a recap, I just want to reiterate a couple of things that it does not do, because you'll probably be hearing about some of these things in the testimony today. First of all, this does not abolish the plan unit development process. There are many circumstances in which the plan unit development process is voluntarily entered into between the developer and a city because of unique site characteristics or novel forms of proposed development that just don't fit within the existing zoning codes. All it does is says that you can't force a developer into the PUD process if they're bringing forward a development that could be approved under the existing zoning ordinances. It does not require cities to only permit affordable housing to be built or compel them to support to build a certain amount. All it does is it opens things up so that if developers see a market for that housing, they are able to build it. It does not establish a new requirement that zoning is subordinate to the comp plan. That has been around since 1995. It does provide clarity around that requirement. And the duplex and ADU provisions do not override existing zoning performance standards, existing setbacks, height and impervious surface coverage requirements, for example, would still have to be met by a property that has a duplex or an ADU. So with that, Mr. Chair, my presentation of the bill is ready. We can take testimony.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Up first, we have Nick Erickson on deck, Peter Coyle. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's deadline week, so I'll be brief. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota. Our mission is homeownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. Really, this bill is a tale of two bills. We have a bill that right now increases housing affordability, access, and removes roadblocks to housing, at the same time adds through a massive homeownership tax. And as I've told my friend Representative Elkins many times over the years, you can't have a bill that both lists and adds roadblocks and expect movement on housing to happen. The impact fees included under Article 1 are housing tax, and they're among the most controversial and litigated tools available to local governments, and unfortunately one that, unlike the other tools available, get tacked on to a mortgage for 30 years at 7%. It's far more affordable to the buyer, a better deal for them to just use the assessment. Other than Article 1, there are a lot of positive things here, and as Representative Elkins has worked on this bill for the last several years, he has put together what has been viewed as, across the country, one of the most progressive and comprehensive housing bills in the country. In fact, his approach has now been used by Oregon, California, Massachusetts, Washington, New York, Colorado are also looking at similar approaches this year. And it's because legalizing missing middle housing, legalizing starter homes, actually makes a difference. I believe you provided a chart from our team today. We got some new market data from Zonda. It shows that in the Midwest, looking across other major markets, Minnesota has less than 2% of all housing under the $300,000 price point. This is a uniquely Minnesota problem outside of coastal regions. Chicago, which everyone thinks is more affordable, has less affordable, actually has 14% of its housing under 300,000. So we started raising the alarm bells on this 5 years ago on housing costs. And at that point in time, a third of all new housing in the metro was under 325. And we thought that was alarming. Now we have that down to 2%. And that's because local government control on housing has been a pernicious problem, one of which resulted in systemic undersupply and a near absolute lack of affordability, but that affordability is seen elsewhere. The results of status quo local government have spoken for themselves. We should all be alarmed and seek to act with urgency on housing. If local government control was the solution, we wouldn't be here today. other than Article 1, really what Representative Elkins has proposed is the missing piece to the policy legislation put forward last week. It brings about a supply-side solution to Minnesota's housing deficit, and it is one that will help build generational wealth for future Minnesotans by enabling pathways to homeownership. Thank you.
Up next, we have Peter Coyle, and on deck, Daniel Lightfoot. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent Housing First Minnesota, and I'm pleased to be here in front of the committee today. In my law practice, which is my day job, I've represented builders and developers throughout the state of Minnesota for nearly 30 years. So these issues that are being raised by Representative Elkins in his bill are near and dear to my heart, and they're tough issues. I'll be upfront with you about that. I want to acknowledge Representative Elkins' genuine effort, sincere effort, to try to get at a very vexing problem. And it's damaging Minnesota's reputation nationally, and that is the extraordinary high cost of building a new house in Minnesota. All kinds of housing, apartments, single family, multifamily, you name it. It's much more expensive to build that product in Minnesota than virtually any place in the country, particularly in our immediate surrounding states, other than on the coast. So it's important that the state address it if it can. I'll start with the positive comment before I get to the negative comment, and Representative Elkins already knows what the negative comment is. And the positive one is, if we do nothing more with this bill than to abolish the use of mandatory PUDs as part of the development of new housing, that will be a huge reform. The PUD process has morphed from being something that was intended to be a flexibility tool for difficult projects to be able to move forward to essentially, in my words, a cram-down tool. A take-it-or-leave-it proposition that's presented to a builder or a developer by a city with a lot of extra costs loaded in that are not justified by the project. So that's an important reform. Unfortunately, Article 1 is a really frightening proposition by itself. It introduces a broad range of costs that could be imposed on new construction, new housing construction, with very broad authority granted to cities to develop plans through their comprehensive plan and capital budgets to implement a fee. And it introduces a variety of topics, schools, public safety buildings, and the like, that have never before been part of any discussion that I've been privy to in which new housing is being constructed or financed as part of a project within a city. So it's a frightening proposition to us because it's already really tough to build a new house in Minnesota at anything close to an affordable price point. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. I realize there's others to testify. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any for me down the road. But I want to leave you with the comment that I think that Representative Elkins is on a good path. The bulk of the bill is terrific. Others may disagree with that characterization. And if we could strike out Article 1, it'd be a home run. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Daniel Lightfoot, and on deck, Jason Weddle. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, the League of Minnesota Cities. I do want to echo the thanks that others have provided to Representative Elkins. We have had numerous conversations on this bill and iterations of this language, and in a few instances in the bill, there have been changes made at the behest of local units of government to address some of the functionality concerns of how a city would operate in terms of residential development and the meaningful parameters put in place by a local unit of government regarding residential development. However, seeing that housing is a statewide issue and each city is tasked with ensuring its own diverse array of housing stock that meets its community-identified housing needs, this bill unfortunately falls short of providing a comprehensive solution to assist both Greater Minnesota cities and metro area cities alike to address individual housing needs and in a heavy-handed way removes local input on land use and zoning decisions best left to the local community. It is the viewpoint of the League and our member cities that any comprehensive housing approach should achieve four key principles. Number one, addressing the full housing spectrum, not just new single-family owner-occupied homes. to support local innovation. We have seen many cities at the local level take an inward look at zoning and land use, as well as the provision of assistance for developers and resources for developers for affordable housing. Three, providing incentives over mandates, and four, providing community-specific solutions throughout the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, we must respectfully oppose House File 2235, as the bill falls short of doing these four things. With that, I would direct your attention to a joint letter in your packets from all of the city organizations, and I'll leave some of the other specific comments on the bill to the two cities that I have here with me today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Jason Weddle. And after that, we have Evan Vogel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the Housing Committee. So my name is Jason Waddell. I'm the city manager for the city of Prior Lake. I'm also a licensed civil engineer and the former director of land development for a national home builder here in the Twin Cities. I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and the Municipal Legislative Commission, which together represent the collective interest of cities across the metro area where the bulk of new home construction is occurring, including in my home city of Prior Lake. We do want to thank Representative Elkins for your work with cities on this bill. However, we do need to respectfully oppose this bill as the provisions in it would provide broad preemptions that would negatively impact cities in the metro area regarding residential development and in no way guarantee affordability. Article 3 would use densities and would require all uses and densities permitted under our city's comprehensive plan. These provisions require cities to upzone what is currently guided for single family housing. And as a civil engineer, I can tell you that our existing infrastructure, our sewer mains, our water mains, they were all designed and constructed and built per our comprehensive and zoning plans based on the guidance of single family homes. So this would require some serious reinvestment in infrastructure. This would also require cities to completely overhaul how we do our long-range planning, forces us to recraft our entire zoning and guiding systems, and forces us to install larger infrastructure in the anticipation that a developer might choose to build a housing product at a higher density than we had anticipated. This article is especially frustrating for cities like ours that have guided land and adjusted our zoning to facilitate the development that builders claim they want to build. We had a recent project where a developer requested smaller lots, which we granted in anticipation of having smaller, lower priced homes. What ultimately happened was the developer came back, asked for variances on the setback so they could squeeze the same larger homes on the small lots. Article 4 is the language on the PUDs. We would argue that each community has its own unique characteristics. We have topography, soils, forests, lakes. We're all unique, and we know best how to facilitate efficient and cost-effective development. So with that, I would just thank you, Chair, and members of the Housing Committee for the time. We look forward to continuing to work with the legislature to develop a strong state and local partnership that doesn't include broad preemptive mandates that in no way guarantee affordability. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Evan Vogel, and after that, Paul Egger. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Howard and committee members. I'm honored to be here today and have the opportunity to testify about this proposed legislation. My name is Evan Vogel, and I'm the city administrator for the city of Cambridge. Today, I'm representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the city of Cambridge, and I'd like to provide some insight from the perspective of a growing city in Greater Minnesota on this piece of proposed legislation. The bill is titled Legalizing Affordable Housing, and I'm concerned that it puts limitations and burden on municipalities and would do little to accomplish its titled goal. This bill focuses on zoning preemption, and it is not at all sensitive to the differing needs of cities, particularly those in Greater Minnesota, when it comes to housing. This legislation continues to advance policies with the stated goal of improving affordability without providing any direct controls to do this, while increasing the burden on our often understaffed cities. It continues to build on the idea that it is undue fees or regulatory burden that are to blame for the rising prices of housing, which simply is not true. Using the criteria established through the state building code, the city recently had two homes, one which was valued at $161,000 and another at $184,000. The city fees totaled $6,193.51, including sack and whack. When isolating simply for the building permit, plan review, and the driveway inspection, the total was $2,719.51. These houses sold for $287,000 and $349,000, respectively. That means the city fees relevant to this property accounted for less than 1% of house number one and less than 0.75% of house number two, further infringing on city's ability to collect appropriate fees or charge, or changes to the code-based regulatory environment will only serve to provide more of a subsidy to developers at the taxpayer expense and harm the underlying safety environment of our homes. Cities are not responsible for the remarkable market-based price increases that we've seen in the housing market, and there's three articles of the bill that I would like to highlight as well. I have concerns with Article 4, which allows dual-family units to be put into single-family environments. Historically, individuals would purchase homes in our community with the understanding that they would be living in a low-density residential environment. And should one of those homes sell and a new home builder want to be putting in a duplex or several, we don't feel that that's appropriate given the expectations of our community at the time when they made those home purchases. We believe this is about housing choice. Article 5 has concerns by mandating specifically the section limiting the width of arterial or collector streets. A 32-foot wide street is insufficient and should not be mandated. It has concerns for adequate parking consideration in smaller communities, snow storage, and impact on multimodal transportation.
Mr. Vogel, if you could conclude.
I will wrap up very quickly. Thank you. Ultimately, I'd simply like to say this. Cambridge residents and those who move to Cambridge from other communities do so to live in Cambridge. Our population has unique needs and sensibilities, and we'd like to advocate for housing choice, and we'd ask that representatives here oppose this legislation as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Paul Egger, and after that, Evan Roberts. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Representative Elkins' House File 2235, and thank you for having this important discussion today, both on Representative Elkins' bill as well as the bill that you're going to hear from Representative Morris next. Minnesota needs more market rate housing, and bringing stakeholders together, cities, builders, and others, to discuss policy options that will result in the construction of more housing of all types by the private sector to better help meet current and future demand is a discussion worth having. Mr. Chair, in January, you provided me with an opportunity to present to the committee on some of the challenges that exist in Minnesota for Minnesotans trying to become homeowners. During that presentation, I shared some data on housing supply, underscoring the need for more inventory. Before the hearing today, I went back and checked our most recent data. And while inventory is up 40%, that means it went from 1 month supply to 1.4 months, which is well short of the 4 to 6 months of supply that represents a balanced market. House File 2235 advances an important discussion about how Minnesota can remove barriers to building more housing and to create more housing opportunities to meet that existing and future demand. While it may be difficult with strong opinions on all sides, the discussion around how to increase the supply of housing needs to include an examination of barriers such as restrictive planning and zoning codes, burdensome permitting processes, and cost drivers resulting from impact fees and other costs on new housing. We share the concerns you heard from Mr. Coyle and Mr. Erickson earlier about the impact fees article in the bill. While we understand there are infrastructure needs associated with building new housing, continuing to increase the cost of housing through impact fees runs counter to making housing more affordable. We also have concerns with the energy cost disclosure requirement in Article 10, and have had many conversations with Representative Elkins going back to last session to outline those concerns. While we do not support the mandate approach in the bill, our members are interested in having a dialogue with Representative Elkins and other stakeholders about opportunities that may exist for making energy cost information more accessible and relevant to buyers. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Next, we have Evan Roberts, and on deck, Greg Metz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. My name is Evan Roberts, and I'm a demographer. I've taught urban history and sociology at the University of Minnesota since 2010. My testimony is informed by my research and teaching, but obviously doesn't represent an official position of view. One of my current projects is developing a zoning atlas or database for Minnesota as part of a broader national effort to develop comparable data on zoning around the country. And as part of this project, I reviewed in depth around 100 metro area zoning codes over the past year. My comments are addressed towards Article 4 and Article 6. These articles both begin to address some of the important causes of rising housing costs by allowing two dwellings on any lot, limiting the amount of parking that a municipality may require, and requiring metro area municipalities to allow more 1/8 of an acre lots. These provisions are broadly in line with legislation in other states and more broadly other common law English-speaking countries with rising housing costs. This legislation in other states, other countries, aims to reduce housing costs, increase housing choices by allowing essentially more families to share the same amount of land and use more of it for housing. That is the gist of a lot of these articles. But they don't go far enough in comparison with legislation being advanced in some other places. You have an opportunity before housing prices increase any further to address these issues following what's been done in other jurisdictions. And I'm going to outline some of where the mainstream of legislation in this area is moving towards allowing at least three units on every lot, removing any requirements for parking, allowing parcels as small as 1,400 square feet. Ultimately, you can't sell a zero square foot house. No one's going to buy that. This is a problem that will solve itself in line with what the size of yard and house that people want to make. Allowing three-story dwellings throughout urban areas, requiring that municipalities allow greater housing production, say up to six stories, within a 10-minute walk of high-capacity transit, particularly where the state has made investments in those transit facilities. Requiring municipalities allow housing to be built on any parcel zoned for commercial, and applying these rules in every urban area and not just the metro. That is where the mainstream of legislation in this area is moving. These issues are a state responsibility, ultimately. They've been largely delegated to cities over the past century, but when that delegation is not working, as it currently is not, it is your role to set new effective policy and guidance for cities in Minnesota. Thank you. I have a handout to provide to you, and I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Greg Metz, and after that, Brian Hoffman. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, community members. My name is Greg Metz. I'm the program manager for the Department of Labor and Industry Construction Codes Rules Writing Unit and Plan Review Units, which are essentially the review and approval side of the building department for the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on House File 2235. DLIA has a few concerns about Article 8 and a clarification of understanding for Article 9. Article 8, Section 2, Subdivision 2, Item B has a much, much broader reach than just housing. It affects all construction. It states that if an agency does not approve a building permit application package within 60 days of the initial application date, that the fees must be fully refunded. DLI, or the Labor and Industry, functions as a construction approving agency, like a building department, much like any other municipality with a building department throughout the state. Our jurisdiction is public buildings and state licensed facilities like hospitals, nursing homes, detention facilities, and public K-12 schools. This affects us as well. These are complex projects, and code compliance is equally complex. Designers miss things, and when they do, they need to correct the documents and coordinate the corrected work for impact in other areas of the project. This process on the design side frequently takes more than 60 days. Other municipalities review other large complex projects as well. This statutory language does not take into consideration the complexity of some projects, the time delay that architects and engineers take to revise the construction documents to comply with codes, or the fact that most building departments operate on a fee-for-service basis outside of the general municipal budget and rely on permit fees to actually pay for the plan review and field inspection services provided. Refunding the fees means that there's not providing sufficient funding for the plan review or field inspections, especially of highly complex projects like hospitals, nursing homes, stadiums, apartment buildings, high-rise buildings, or even complex large homes. Construction codes are not in place to serve and protect the individual building owner, although that is a positive end result. They're in place to preserve and protect our communities by establishing reliable standards for construction, durability, and fire safety. These standards protect community property values, and the safety and stability of the community as a whole.
Mr. Metz, if you could conclude, please.
Thank you. DLI recommends striking the proposed changes to Article 8, Section 2 in order to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next, we have Brian Hoffman, and on deck, Lisa Beth Barajas. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Howard, committee members, and Representative Elkins. Brian Hoffman, I'm serving on the board of the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, known as AMBO, representing code officials and inspectors throughout the state of Minnesota. And we appreciate Representative Elkins reaching out to us throughout the year in the past and to talk and discuss some areas. However, Article 8, which would establish the 60-day rule that was just being discussed by Mr. Metz, is very concerning to us. Not because of not being able to get a plan review done in 60 days. However, there's an unintended consequence very possible here that happens quite frequently. Large plans especially, whether they be apartment complexes or commercial buildings or office towers, they come in and sometimes it does require sending plans to other agencies, health departments at the county or the state. The plans would include building, mechanical, plumbing, electrical, site. So there's a lot of things that go into this, and it's almost inevitable that there are some things that are overlooked. So at the end of a plan review process, the city will issue a plan review letter saying to the designers what needs to be added or changed to have a code compliant set of plans. Now these plans are huge, and once we give out that plan review, the city has no control whatsoever with how quickly the developer has their design team respond. It may be a week, it may be several months. Last year, as an example, in the community I work, we had three apartment buildings that were affordable housing that basically just waited up to 6 or 8, 9 months until funding came through before they finally said, okay, now let's get the plans completed and get the process rolling. So in all these cases, the developer does not really want the city to say, well, 60 days is up, let's deny it, let's return your fees, only to have to turn around and reapply, resubmit, and bring the fees forward again. So it adds basically a level of complexity that's really not cooperative or working in the sense of service delivery with our customers. And so that's the concern. Hopefully that could be changed. I want to thank you for your
thank you. Next, we have Lisa Beth Barajas, and last, we have Bradley Shoppe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Lisa Beth Barajas, the Executive Director of the Community Development Division at the Metropolitan Council, and I'm pleased to be here today. Really, like other presenters, want to thank Representative Elkins for the time that he spent working with me over the last couple of years and some of the issues that we've shared. But first, I want to speak to some of the things we do like about this bill. Article 12 in particular, we really appreciate repealing those two session laws for those two particular cities. They're the only two cities in the metro area that have these sort of exceptions in law, and any change that those cities might want to undertake in the future would require the legislature to pass another session law. So repealing those would bring those two communities back into essentially the fold with the other 188 communities in the metro area. Second, I would like to fully support the provisions in Article 2 regarding environmental review and comprehensive plans. The court's decision on the Minneapolis case inserts a significant amount of uncertainty into both regional and local planning processes at the policy level, where we're exploring concepts and visions for the future. And so this clarification in law would really take that uncertainty out of that. It does not exempt any projects from undergoing environmental review, which is really important. That is still in there and is still part of law and still governed under the Minnesota Environmental Protection Act. We do have concerns with a couple of other articles, however, and that includes the Article 3, which regards provisions between planning and zoning relationship, as well as livable communities requirements for enrollment in the program. The proposed language has the effect of making land use guiding and comprehensive plans the same as zoning, and gets in the way of having long-range plans being 20 years into the future and zoning, which is what's allowable today, which can get in the way of staging for future development as well. Livable communities programs, unfortunately, we don't experience the issues that Representative Elkins had mentioned, but we do want to make that program as open to communities as possible because it is the one incentive tool we have in the metro to support affordable housing production, and the more participation we can have in that program, the better. And finally, I have to say on the last two articles, 6 and 7, setting densities and SAC, minimum SAC charges, those are issues that we think are best decided with the region and the local governments together through our regional planning process. We are just undertaking our 2050 planning update right now in the region. And unlike other states, we do have a regional authority that is responsible for doing this work. And we think that these issues are best discussed, researched, and debated with all local units of government within the metropolitan area, and with the analysis and research and the funding that we bring to the table in operating those systems. So thank you again. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. And last, we have Bradley Shoppy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and committee. My name is Bradley Shoppy. I am an attorney and real estate attorney and City of Minnetonka council member. Full disclosure, I'm here by myself. I don't represent the City of Minnetonka, just by individual comments. And I also can freely comment, meaning I'm not running for re-election. I'm a political centrist, and I don't represent a special interest. I'm actually losing billable time to be here. I think the question presented for everyone above the bill language is state legislation necessary to preempt cities on local zoning? And my position from my experience in Minnetonka is yes. I believe too many cities hide behind the phrase of local control that restricts the supply of housing, meaning American Enterprise Institute, from truly market participants, not from a benevolent homes for all, but truly just market participant analysis. And I believe the question presented is better focused on the how and where. How and where do we consider local control? Do we consider, the preemption? Is it in the modification of duplex language or in other states such as Washington, where they're focusing on a hybrid approach with transit-oriented development, where they have still some local control and how that steps down? Real briefly, in terms of Minnetonka, in 2021, the median house price was $405,000. In 2023, it is now $496,000 in 2 years. That's where we're at. And while we do good things, we have added new ADU housing that is allowable. I think that's a benefit to multi-generation families. And we do add new apartment rental homes in two areas of our town. The rest of it is predominantly single family home zoning. And we do not have new home ownership that's affordable that's at all offered to the market. It just simply doesn't happen. Anecdotally, we've had a Habitat for Humanity proposal, not a proposal, a concept that is no application yet, that went before some neighbors and has been on ice for a year due to the fact that it would need a zoning change and opposition to that. And so generally from my experience, what we see is friction, right? We see neighborhood character, traffic, environmental concerns, they come up over and over again. And so to kind of summarize just anecdotal experience in Minnetonka is, yes, there's rental housing being offered, but the American dream really is buying your own home. It is purchasing a home, and that is becoming harder and harder to do, and our community is not doing that. So wherever you stand with specifics on the bill, my hope is that you consider the fact that we some level of state preemption is necessary. My personal viewpoint is that I think there can be more focus on corridors and transit-oriented development as a first step versus jumping into duplexes everywhere, where we could kind of keep everyone happy. We've heard testimony.
If you could conclude your comments, please.
Okay, testimony about infrastructure in place and where that's at. So thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate everyone listening.
Thank you. Members, we have a few amendments filed. First, there's an A1. Who will be offering the A1? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd offer the A1 and request a roll call. A1, as we've heard, is the tax on houses. And Representative Elkins and I have worked on this same issue at the same time, and we've spoken together at some of the same conferences. But this is not the solution, in my opinion, that some of what he's asking for, like on street impact fees and other impact fees, and it is a tax on houses. And many of these would be collected on the front end of the building of a development and may not actually impart benefit to the people who choose to live there. This is very expensive, and I do not believe that this is the solution to the problem. I think I love the rest of the bill. I think there's some really great things in there that we can talk about and that we should be embracing. But I do think that the A1 gets to the heart of the issue that I have been advocating for many, many years. And I think that if we could remove this, we'd have a great bill. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. I am probably, by the time that you get to see this bill again in state and local government, probably going to replace Article 1 with a replacement that is based on the current Chapter 444, which is an existing assessment mechanism that's used by cities to finance sewer and water right now. Looking it over, I'm working on it with Chelsea Griffin. I think we can probably just add transportation to that existing statute and will accomplish the objectives that I'm looking at. It was actually an idea that originally kind of came to me from former Representative Hurtas a while back. But I never knew the specific legislative reference until very recently. I think that it's incredibly important for cities to have a way to finance the infrastructure that housing necessitates. I think that in the big picture, I think that the biggest cause of higher cost housing isn't the fees and the mandates, the aesthetic mandates and things like that. I think it's just basically, as one of the testifiers talked about, it's just being able to build a house on less land. We just need to increase the supply of buildable lots at price points that would allow a builder to build affordable homes. And the best way for us to expand the supply of buildable lots is give cities the tool that they need in order to expand, to allow people to create buildable lots.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't disagree that we need to address the inventory, and modest densification is a term that is used and I think is great. But again, I do think that taking out this piece will be helpful to the bill. Again, many of the people who will buy a house that will go through these taxes, I think the average duration of somebody that lives in a house in Minnesota is 8 years. In the bill, I believe it's still 30 years that it can be held for. At least it wasn't your last bill. But there's a very strong argument to be made that if you collect this and someone may move out, they will not get that refunded and it will not actually impart the benefit that they're trying to achieve. So, Mr. Chair, just ask for the roll call on the A1. Thank you.
Any other further discussion to the A1? Any other comments, Representative Elkins, to the amendment?
Amend a no vote on
okay.
This amendment.
Then clerk will take the roll.
Chair Howard.
Chair votes no.
Chair Howard, nay. Vice Chair Igbaje.
No.
Vice Chair Igbaje, nay. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Cha.
No.
Representative Cha, nay. Representative Dotseth.
Yes.
Representative Dotseth, aye. Representative Hassan.
No.
Representative Hassan, nay. Representative Hussein. Representative Hussein, nay. Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Kozlowski, nay. Representative Myers.
Aye.
Representative Myers, aye. Representative Nash. Representative Nash, aye. Representative Norris?
No.
Representative Norris, nay. Representative Perez Vega?
No.
Representative Perviga, nay. Representative Petersburg.
Aye.
Representative Petersburg, aye. Chair, that concludes roll call with 5 ayes and 8 nays.
The A1 does not succeed. The A2, who's offering the A2?
I am.
Representative Myers.
Chair Howard, thank you. Representative Elkins, thank you. You know, I will echo some of the stuff that Representative Nash said and some of the testifiers said about, you know, some good things in the bill that, you know, with further discussion, I think we can make it better. But the A2 amendment here is, you know, something that, you know, I've gone through twice. But in your bill, what I'm doing is taking the disclosure requirement out for sellers and just leaving it in for buyers that get to the point that they decided that's the house for them, that's the, you know, the place for them, that then they have the requirement or that opportunity to go to, you know, the utility company to request what the costs have been for a 12-month period. So I'm hoping you'll be able to, you know, support that amendment.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, so this article, as it's written right now, reflects the fact that for a new home, there is no history, but that the builders are accustomed to providing information about the, the HERS index, the estimated fuel energy efficiency of a new home. But I fundamentally think that in both for that information and the historical cost information, that's information that ought to be provided in the real estate listing. And a home buyer right now just doesn't have, you know, isn't guaranteed to have either of those two pieces of information. And it's just kind of mind-boggling to me that a home buyer just can't see that as part of the listing.
Representative Myers.
And I can appreciate that with new builds. I can tell you, you know, when you purchase a home, a lot of times you get so many disclosures already that you sometimes probably don't read all of them. I think, you know, we have a fairly robust disclosure requirement for sellers. And I think, you know, this is an opportunity that as people get closer to making an offer or truly considering, purchasing a property, that they have the opportunity to go and get that information.
With that, I will call the vote on the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. 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 The amendment is not adopted. So we're to the bill before us. Members, I want to note that it's 4:00. So I want to give members a chance to speak, but if you can keep your remarks brief because we do have another bill on the agenda. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask for a roll call on the vote.
Roll call requested on the bill. There will be a roll call.
Chair, and I'll just I'll quickly say that Mr. Shappy from Minnetonka, I agree that there is a case to be made for some preemption. I think that you've heard me say I'm a big believer in local control. I believe that I do not, however, support local out of control, and I think there have been some cities that have gotten out over their skis, and I think Representative Elkins agrees with that. I did try very hard to get you some yes votes out of my side, but the tax on folks is just too much. I think that there are a lot of good things in this bill, but I cannot support it at this time, and I appreciate the roll call. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Elkins. I think you said earlier, just a little while ago, that this Article 1 will probably be replaced, and so I'm going to give you some food for thought, and that is that under your permitted uses for these fees, if you keep anything like that in place, almost all of them are ongoing expenses that are also needed for already established housing and developments. And what's troubling for me is that these fees that you're going to be charging to the developer of that land, which what I understand, are going to be passed on then to the purchasers of those homes. And your premise is that this bill was to reduce the cost of housing. And so in essence, what you're doing is you're passing on these fees to the individual purchaser of the home because the developer is going to pass it on. And then through property taxes are going to collect for the ongoing expenses of those anyway, in which if you were to buy a open lot that's in between two other houses and you build a house there, you're not going to be charged those fees and would have just your property taxes reflected in it. So I think there's some challenges here in which you are have really tried to do an awful lot, and I think on good pretense, but what you're doing is it's actually kind of a double take and double charge to the person who's going to be purchasing this. You know, I do know that in transportation we've dealt with street improvement districts and how difficult it is to deal with that. So I know that you're familiar with it that way as well. But in this particular way, the reasons and what you're be collecting for is normal expenses that is usually paid for by property taxes. And so I'm for food for thought, you know, this if you do redo that section of it, I would certainly consider that. Thank you.
Other members? Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative, number one, I just have to say this is definitely in my wheelhouse, so I can appreciate the intent behind this, and I think there's some good language in here. Yeah, I think all the way from allowing more density, I think that's a good intent that you're actually pursuing here. I think banning some of the aesthetic mandates are important, all the way down to capping some of these additional park dedication fees are very helpful. However, there's still a lot more we can do with this bill. I guess we look at the impact provision as, I think we need to look at cutting that out. I think that, you know, we've heard that here today, the 60-day rule. I think we've heard some discussion on that, the energy costs. I think this bill still has just a long way to go before we can actually, I can honestly vote yes, but you're that close. But so thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Sure, Howard. Representative Elkins, I understand you've been working on this for a while. Unfortunately, it needs a lot more work. You see, you've changed it to some of just a pilot project in the metro area, because that's where a lot of the problems are in my area and where Mr. Vogel spoke about the city of Cambridge. We don't have a lot of the issues we're talking about. We have affordable housing. We have low-income housing. We have the gamut. I like some of the things that you have in the bill dealing with preemption, but it's not every city that has that issue, and it's hand-tying those that are doing it right by forcing them to do things that it doesn't always fit for that particular area or that particular development. But we do have some other cities that they could use some preemption because they've done their zoning to a point where it completely shuts out moderately priced homes. Mm-hmm. So I commend you for trying to do that. But you have to take a bigger look. Right now I cannot support this bill. I don't think anybody should support this bill because there's a lot of housing policy issues in this bill that need to be fixed before it moves on. So with that, I'm going to ask members to vote no.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to speak to energy cost disclosure requirement in Article 10. I think that's a great piece. A lot of time BIPOC owners or, you know, just, you know, first-time home buyers, they buy into a house. They don't know the energy efficiency. It doesn't have dual pane windows. And they end up paying this really high, you know, energy bill, right? And so I think that piece is vitally important because we have, you know, disclosure for cars, right? Efficiency, right? We have disclosure for appliances. Why don't we have it for homes? And I'm one of those people that will probably read every page to make sure that it's being disclosed. So thank you for that piece.
I'm just going to make a quick comment, and I would make a longer comment, ask more questions if we had more time. But Representative Elkins, I do want to thank you for your work on this bill over a number of years. You've worked earnestly to try to get it some issues that I think are really important. I'm going to be voting yes because I think it's important to move this conversation forward. I do think the state has a vested interest in this issue, in this conversation, and in particular the elements of your bill that aim to add more density for housing feels to me like a necessary part of the solution to our housing crisis. I think the next bill is also a necessary part of the solution to our housing crisis. I just wanted, before I go to your concerns, one of the testifiers kind of made the notion of, to the local control piece of we know best. And I just want to highlight that that kind of thinking has been used to create some pretty poor zoning and planning and housing decisions over history in our state. And so I think it is important for us to continue to have this conversation, and that's why I'll be voting yes. But Representative Elkins, a final comment on your bill.
Final comment. I've been working on this bill for about a year and a half now, and will continue to. I actually got some really good feedback today. Mr. Hoffman in particular has been a really good partner in terms of working through some of the building code provisions. He made some good comments today, and we'll be working with, continue to work with him on some of that stuff. Mr. Chair, a comment you made is, you know, right spot on. It's just under the current situation, it's not in the interest of any individual city to foster more affordable housing. I used to represent a city where the common perspective was, well, why do we need a affordable housing in our city? That's what we have the city next door for. As long as cities have that attitude, their interests are not aligned with the general public interest. We need more housing at all price points of all types, and we're not getting it because it's not permitted to be built right now. So would appreciate everyone's support in moving this bill along to state and local government, where we will continue the conversation.
Mr. Abdullahi, take the roll, please.
Chair Howard.
Chair votes aye.
Chair Howard, aye. Vice Chair Gbaje.
Yes.
Vice Chair Gbaje, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Cha.
Cha, yes.
Representative Cha, aye. Representative Dotseth.
No.
Representative Dotseth, nay. Representative Hassan.
Hassan votes aye.
Representative Hassan, aye. Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Representative Hussein, aye. Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski, aye. Representative Myers.
Nay.
Representative Myers, nay. Representative Nash.
Nope.
Representative Nash, nay. Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Norris, aye. Representative Perez Vega.
Perez Vega, aye.
Perez Vega, aye. Representative Petersburg.
No.
Representative Petersburg, nay. Chair, that concludes roll call with 8 ayes and 5 nays.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is re-referred to the House State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you. Representative Elkins. Up next, Representative Norris. And members, we do have the ability to go a little bit long, and I want to make sure there is time. So we will go till 4:40, and we'll have a hard stop at 4:40. Representative Norris, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Chair Howard. I move House File 743 for referral to the Tax Committee.
And I understand that you have an author's amendment. Could you please explain your author's amendment?
Yes, Chair Howard. So the A1 amendment deals with the TIF provisions in Section 10. It basically incorporates some recommendations made by the Office of the State Auditor to avoid some unintended consequences of the program design.
All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A1 is adopted. Representative Norris, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members. I'll apologize in advance. I didn't realize a PowerPoint was required for this assignment, but I'll proceed nonetheless. So, Chair Howard and members, we know we're in a housing affordability crisis. One way to address that is by increasing supply. Another is policy solutions to address regulatory or market conditions that are increasing prices. This bill aims to incentivize the conditions that create affordability throughout our state. It does it in four different ways. First, it addresses the full spectrum of housing from preservation up through market rate. For instance, it extends eligibility of housing infrastructure bonds to the construction, acquisition, and rehabilitation of permanent housing affordable to incomes at or below 50% AMI, and provides a preference for even deeper affordability. It authorizes $400 million in housing infrastructure bonds, $50 million to help preserve naturally occurring affordable housing, and $100 million for public housing rehabilitation. It also establishes a real estate excise tax to discourage large corporations from purchasing large numbers of single-family homes, and provides additional revenue to address housing needs. Second, this bill supports local innovation that cities are deploying to address needs and promote development. For example, it adds workforce housing projects to eligible projects that an HRA or EDA can undertake so that local units of government can more easily develop workforce housing. It also increases the statutory levy limit for HRAs to provide more resources for them to address local affordable housing needs. It allows statewide eligibility for local units of government to transfer unobligated increment from a TIF district to a local housing trust fund. Third, this bill provides incentives to cities that allow for local efforts that meet diverse and local needs. For example, it includes matching grants to cities in greater Minnesota that will cover up to 50% of the capital costs of the public infrastructure necessary for workforce housing. It directs Minnesota Housing to establish and administer a grant program to reimburse cities up to 50% of the cost for fee waivers or reductions to qualified new multifamily and single-family developments or for locally established inclusionary housing programs. And it has $10 million for matching grants to local units of government that commit non-state resources to a local housing trust fund. Fourth and lastly, it allows for community-specific solutions that are sensitive to the different housing needs across cities and regions. For example, it authorizes any city by ordinance to establish a relocation assistance program for displaced tenants in the event of the demolition, substantial rehabilitation, or change of use of affordable housing. And it's got $5 million for a pilot program to provide grants to municipalities to cover up to 50% of the cost of infrastructure that would otherwise be required to be paid by the developer for new housing developments. I want to stress, members, that this bill is the start of a conversation. Some of the appropriations you'll notice in this bill are blank. The excise tax language needs some fine-tuning to achieve its intended goal, and I'm open to ongoing conversations with the stakeholders. But what this bill does do is bring many different tools to the table for our consideration when putting together our omnibus bill to achieve our goal of affordable housing for all Minnesotans.
Thank you, Representative Norris. First up, we have Daniel Lightfoot, and after that, Cherry Shoquist-Henderson. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Daniel Leif with the League of Minnesota Cities. First off, I want to thank Representative Norris for his authorship of the bill and for his leadership on housing issues. I think, unlike the last piece of legislation that was considered by the committee, we do believe that this piece of legislation does guarantee affordability in so many ways that are very important to our local units of government. It does provide incentivization of some of the changes at the local level rather than broad brushstrokes and one-size-fits-all mandates. I do think that, to Representative Norris's point, some of these provisions you have seen in this committee before. For example, the Local Housing Trust Fund state matching grants, capital investment resources for housing. But we view this comprehensive approach as a really important method to ensure that we are not only looking at the entire housing spectrum that our cities have to ensure for their residents, but also take into account the regional differences and the city-to-city differences of unique housing needs. When you've been to one city in this state, you've been to one city. And all of them have different housing needs, and we view this bill in the policy and resources provided as a great way and a great path to help local units of government address their locally identified housing needs. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of city testifiers here as well to speak on both the metro perspective of this bill and as well as greater Minnesota.
Thank you. First, we have Cherry Shoquist-Henderson, on deck Scott McMahon.
Good afternoon, Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Sherry Shoquist, and I serve as the City of Golden Valley. And thank you, Representative Norris, for authoring this act. I'm here to provide a metro area perspective and focus on the importance of the bill's provision for a inner suburb like Golden Valley to address our local housing needs across the housing spectrum. I have the benefit of working for a city that is 100% committed to affordable housing and committed to meeting a variety of housing needs for our residents and residents of the metro region. We do have challenges in developable land and funding to fill affordability gaps at all levels. We find that our main goals include the preservation of existing affordable housing and advancing development projects that provide mixed income housing in our city to assist us in meeting our affordability goals and providing full spectrum housing needs. We are in support of Section 15 for the naturally occurring affordable housing preservation. We are in support of Section 17 to establish a local housing trust fund that, in addition to flexibility for tax increment financing, to be able to use those funds to add to affordable housing trust fund would help us meet some of those deeper affordability levels and help incentivize developers that are already wanting to work with cities like Golden Valley and are committed to developing at that 60% AMI level, but really struggling to get the 50 and 30% AMI. And obviously, the other provisions of the bill, especially the excise tax and the housing cost reduction incentive program, are other tools that would be very useful to cities in the metro area. So thank you for the opportunity to share our metro area perspective today.
Thank you. Next, we have Scott McMahon, and up next after that, Melissa Taphorn. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Scott McMahon. I'm here on behalf of the Greater Minnesota Partnership to share our perspective on housing in Greater Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Norris for bringing this very important bill forward. As was previously described in the last bill and in Mr. Lightfoot's comments kicking off this bill, we need scalpel approaches to housing. Every community is different. The solution in one community is not the solution in the next community. And this bill provides a whole lot of scalpels for the metro, for Greater Minnesota, to address our housing issues. We need more housing in Greater Minnesota. We are short in every community. We have communities that haven't had a new housing unit built in years. The reason that that is because we have market failure in Greater Minnesota. When you take the five cost drivers of housing development between labor, materials, land acquisition, financing, and public infrastructure, those costs are more than our market will support. So to give you an example, if you build a new house for that costs $325,000 to build, the bank's going to tell you that that house appraises for $250,000. How do you build a new house when you have that type of market situation? You heard earlier this year from Mayor Fabian, former Representative Fabian from Roseau, about an apartment complex that they built up there. 37 units, cost $6.5 million to construct. It appraised for $4 million when it was done. The city of Roseau, through every tool they had at that project, from tax abatement to TIF to fee waivers to you name it, just to try and get that housing developed. That is the case that we face in communities like Austin, Marshall, Glencoe, Virginia, wander through Greater Minnesota. That's the reality that we face. The provisions in this bill give us a lot more tools to address these problems. Investing in supporting communities to help subsidize the public infrastructure, to build new housing, helps decrease those costs. Giving them the flexibility to figure out different financing tools, different structures, to have those around there. These are the types of solutions that we need in Greater Minnesota to get our housing built. We're happy that this bill is being heard. We strongly encourage you to find ways to roll these provisions into your omnibus bill. These are the things that will start swinging hammers in Greater Minnesota and getting more housing built in our community. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Melissa Taphorn, and last, Paul Egger. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Howard and committee members. My name is Melissa Taphorn. I am the Executive Director of the Washington County Community Development Agency, as well as the Legislative Chair for Minnesota NARO, which is the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. Our organization is a membership organization of over 150 housing authorities, housing and redevelopment authorities, and public housing authorities for agencies across the state. We are on the front lines of this housing crisis, trying to promote strong and viable communities throughout Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 743. I will limit my remarks to just those that directly affect our members. That is increasing the HRA levy rate, expanding the HRA powers to include workforce housing, and appropriating funds to the publicly owned housing program. One of the most powerful tools the legislature has equipped HRAs with is the special benefit tax levy. It's flexible, and I hate to say this, but locally controlled, given the context of the conversation today. And three, it bolsters our local housing markets. Our communities face unique housing issues, and our solutions are equally unique. Some HRAs use our levy funds to create multifamily rentals. Others use it to provide down payment assistance, and others provide funds to housing improvement programs. And they, you know, there's everything in between and full spectrum, right? HRA levies are the primary source for those local housing trust funds as well. The proposed increase to the levy maximum in Section 9 of this bill provides the flexibility for local elected officials to fund a variety of programs that meet their pressing housing challenges, and they determine when it is needed. The increased rate is well-timed when the overall housing needs are significant and there is much at stake for communities. The legislature has also empowered HRAs with a broad spectrum of programs to address our housing markets, expanding that list to include affordable or workforce housing to address the middle income range is essential to so many of our communities and HRAs. Our businesses can't survive without employees. We can't attract new businesses without available workers. And many greater Minnesota and pockets of the metro cannot absorb increases to the workforce because we don't have the housing to house them. So we eagerly welcome this opportunity. I've spoken to you before about the need for additional resources to rehabilitate our public housing units, and thank you for acknowledging and valuing the need to invest in the upkeep and renovation of our public housing units. Appropriating cash, the public housing or publicly owned housing program will provide flexibility to leverage future investment in these properties. Public housing is home to some of our lowest income seniors and families. They deserve a safe, secure, and dignified place to live. Thank you, Representative Norris, and the other bill authors for the inclusion of these tools for HRAs, and we look forward to being part of the solution to the full spectrum of housing issues across the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Last, we have Paul Egger. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Paul Egger, Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few thoughts and some concerns that I had an opportunity to share with Representative Norris. Look forward to continuing the dialogue with him as the bill moves forward. I think the discussion today has been a really helpful one. Mr. Chair, thank you for taking the time to hear both of these bills. The Elkins bill has a lot of good ideas in it that are worth continued dialogue amongst all the stakeholders and committee members of the legislature, and I think the bill that Representative Norris has in front of you, also ideas like infrastructure grants and fee reduction waivers are good ideas that I think getting all these out on the table are helpful moving forward. I also do, though, want to take a few minutes to address concerns with a couple of provisions in the bill. The real estate excise tax in Section 2, you know, we believe enacting a new real estate excise tax on certain buyers would certainly obviously make buying property more expensive for some, but it is not going to do anything to address the supply issue that we've been talking about today. With the rising interest rates over the past year, including I think today, rates are jumping even a little bit higher. The market is certainly cooled, but there still are not enough homes. And we've talked about that data earlier in the hearing and earlier this session, so I won't take your time on that today, but clearly we have a problem with having enough housing to meet current and future demand. If there were more homes available, existing and new, to better balance supply and demand, there would be less interest in the market from investors. So the best way to minimize role investors in the market is to increase the supply of housing. And also just want to point out on this excise tax that increasing taxes on the purchases of properties will increase the cost of housing for subsequent buyers or renters, because that cost will be passed on by the corporate entity. And I just want to briefly address the relocation assistance in Section 11, which would allow cities to require that a property owner provide relocation assistance to all tenants of affordable housing units as defined in the bill. You know, requiring that property owners provide relocation assistance would be costly and may result in unintended consequences such as rent increases to cover potential liability of having to provide relocation assistance and depressing new investment in affordable housing units. Instead of an unfunded mandate on property owners, the legislature could fund tenant relocation assistance directly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the time today.
Thank you. We do have the A2 amendment. Who's offering the A2? Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, the A2 amendment takes the ... and actually puts in a dollar amount. $2. The reason we brought it up is we've had a number of bills go through this committee, and this is a finance committee with no appropriations, just the dots. We need to start looking at what those dollars are. I'm sure by now you've had your targets. We've had the budget forecast. It's time to start doing the work. We have the first deadline on Friday. So with that, this is more to talk about the fact that we have a lot of bills that we don't know what the numbers are. It's time to start doing that and putting the numbers in place so we have an idea what's going on. We've had over $6 billion go through this committee so far, and that's not counting the dots. So with that, I will withdraw the amendment, but it was a talking point to make sure that we start looking at the numbers.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. When you did your math, though, it could have been, you know, $6 billion and $2 if we would have. But thank you, and we're getting there. Member discussion. Anybody? Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Norris, I understand where you're coming from on this bill. There's some good ideas in it. But one of the problems I see is, or one of the good things I see is that 50%. I wish we had a number on there how much money was going to that program because we need that throughout the state. Workforce housing in greater Minnesota is a huge issue. Everywhere we look, there's jobs available, and a lot of the jobs are highly skilled jobs that when a company does find somebody to actually fill that highly skilled position, there's no housing for them. And you can't buy a house overnight. It takes time to buy a house or a home. The other problem I have with this bill is the fact that when you get down to the public housing, it's just shifting the dollars. It's not fixing the cost for building a home. It's not fixing the dollars that are fixing the price. It's shifting the cost. Privately owned housing units, they have to do the upkeep and maintenance out of the funds that they are able to get from rent. Public housing doesn't. We have hundreds of millions of dollars to do that. And all that is doing, taking the taxpayer dollars that was overpaid to the state of Minnesota to the point of $19 billion, and taking that money and giving it to somebody else to fix the housing that we're supplying vouchers for through most likely through Section 8 housing to cover those costs of rent. And now we're covering the cost of building, maintenance, and repair. Yes, is public housing important? Absolutely. But the cost of that housing needs to be built into the price of the rent, and not be subsidized by taxpayer dollars on another end. I do thank Representative Norris for bringing this forward. There is some good things in this bill, but those are things that we need to work on and find a way to shift the costs to where they belong. We have nonprofits that are at the 30% AMI that are looking at, and it's the largest ones in this state, going out of business because of these costs. They don't get this money because they're not public housing. But they are helping the bottom, the lowest percentage, those in the homelessness, those just getting into housing units. And they might go out of business. But we're taking money and giving it to facilities that cities have taken the responsibility for and giving them tax dollars from citizens that have no part of those cities. So with that, I will leave it there, and I hope you can get it worked out. I'm hoping this bill does come back here so we can actually fill in the dots. And one other thing is the taxing of the corporate. Most builders are corporate entities. They're going to build a development. They might do spec homes. That just increased the cost of those houses because of the tax, which is not what we want to do. Also, a huge part of senior housing is corporate entities that build large complex of single, duplex, fourplex, or larger independent living communities for seniors. I have a number of them in my district. That would take that away because it'd now be taxed, increasing the cost, making it less viable for seniors to live in those independent living areas where they're, and their rent takes care of the everything from maintenance of their unit to snow removal. And they've used a lot of that this year. Lawn upkeep, maintenance of the roads, maintenance of the water and sewer system. But I'm afraid with this bill, with those taxes, it's going to then shutting that out. So that's the last thing we need, because I'm one of the last of the baby boomers. I'm going to need that soon. And so it's, unfortunately, I liked a lot of the ideas in this bill, but right now, the way it sits, I cannot support it.
Representative Norris, Representative Shah.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you, Representative Norris, for continuously chipping at the housing crisis of Minnesota. And the conversation is really needed, and we're having them, and that's healthy, right? And so I just want to know that your efforts are well noted. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski.
That came quick. Thank you, Chair Howard. And Representative Norris, I also want to just echo and say, you know, thank you for bringing forward this bill. As we've heard from many, there's a ton of support for it, and for good reason. You know, coming from greater Minnesota, across the state, everywhere, affordable housing is holding our communities back, and it's holding our communities down. And so I really like, you know, the pieces in this bill, the 50% reimbursement to greater Minnesota, especially for the infrastructure hookups. We know in my community, we talk about housing is really a math problem, and especially when we have cities that are spread out, that makes it particularly challenging. So I really like that. Also the $10 million to our local housing trust funds. My question is on the excise tax, the 97% going to the state and the 3% to the county. Can you just walk us through again about why did the county, and then how were those dollars go out to benefit the increased development of affordable housing, for example? You know, will those flow into a housing trust fund, or how does our community then hold those dollars accountable back to developing and making sure that those dollars are then back for housing?
Representative Norris.
Chair Howard and Representative Kozlowski, thanks for that question. If it's all right, I'm actually going to defer to Mr. Lightfoot to talk a little bit more about the design of that particular element.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kozlowski. It's a good question. The key that we had with that provision was to ensure that And as Representative Norris noted, that provision's in this bill as the start of a conversation of what the state role might be in addressing and mitigating the challenges that many local units of government are having on the negative effects of corporate purchases of single-family owner-occupied homes, then transitioning them into single-family rental. I'd have to look back and see specifically in tax policy why there was a portion retained at the county level. I believe it has something to do with the administration and collection of the tax itself, so as not to have an unfunded mandate on counties. But I'd have to look to make sure. And then, you know, the provision would allow a local unit of government, to your point, to utilize the proceeds of that excise tax in any manner that they saw fit for affordable housing. It could certainly be own source public revenue into a local housing trust fund, to your point.
Anything further, Kozlowski?
Right. I really appreciate that answer and that clarification. Obviously, we'll have a part to play in it, in the state and the county, our local governments and private partners. So this is a really good bill, and I'm going to be really proud to support it today. Thank you.
Representative Norris, I want to thank you for your work. I want to thank Mr. Lightfoot and the League as well for putting together a suite of packages, of bills, some that we've heard in the past, some that I can guarantee will be part of a package that this House is going to move forward. And I did want to highlight just to the notion of I think it was Mr. McMahon from the Greater Minnesota Housing Partnership who mentioned the market failure to build housing that's affordable. And we could literally do all of the bill we did previously, but if we're not making public investment, we're not going to build the affordable, especially the deeply affordable housing. So we need to have both the conversation on policy and funding, and I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. And with that, I will renew the motion that House, oh, actually, Representative Norris, we're short on time, but I will give you a minute to give us a closing comment.
Thanks, Chair Howard. I'll be brief. I just want to thank the members for the discussion. As I said, you know, I'm really bringing this bill forward as the start of a conversation of some different tools we can consider. I appreciate the comments by Lee Johnson. I think the point you raised, and I mentioned, you know, the excise tax, I think we've got some work to do. I think the part about, you know, senior communities is particularly well taken. We're going to take this bill to tax next and kind of maybe sharpen up that piece around the excise tax, and then I'm sure, as you said, some of these provisions will probably be coming back to us in the form of our omnibus bill.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 743 is amended be re-referred to the House Taxes Committee. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to taxes. Members, I really appreciate the discussion. We are adjourned.